Hello, I'm Andrew Yeager, and thanks for joining me for this special Candidates Forum on your NPR news station, 90.3 WBHM or 91.5 WSGN. Today, we feature a moderated discussion between the two candidates in the Republican primary runoff for Alabama's 6th Congressional District, State Representative Paul DeMarco and policy analyst Gary Palmer. The forum was recorded June 24th at the Jefferson State Community College Shelby Hoover campus. It was sponsored by Jeff State, the Greater Shelby County Chamber of Commerce, AARP Alabama, WBRC Fox 6, and WBHM. We now turn to the moderator, Fox 6 anchor Jonathan Hardison, as he explains the forum's format.
Each candidate will have 90 seconds to provide a response to my questions. We'll have two-minute closing statements at the very end. We flipped a coin backstage, and Mr. Palmer will begin the closing statements. Mr. DeMarco will provide the last closing statement when we get to that point. We have a timer up here to help try and keep us on track. We're going to answer the questions in alphabetical order. So the first question goes to Mr. DeMarco first, and then Mr. Palmer will have a minute and a half. And again, I remind the candidates to try and stick as close to time as we can. Look forward to a productive discussion. Again, with a question that may seem obvious, but perhaps we can get a more deep answer here. And that is the question that all journalists ask of why. Why in the world would you run for Congress, a branch of our government that has had record low approval ratings, bipartisanship has for the most part stalled, is considered an ineffective institution in many cases at the present time. So why bother running for this office, Mr. DeMarco?
Thank you. And I want to thank the sponsors for having us and Jeff State and for all of y'all being here tonight. Thank you. Yeah, people have asked me that question a lot. They said, what were you thinking? I mean, you got to be crazy for doing this. And I always start off by saying, well, my wife's a clinical psychologist, so I get counseling every night. But I'm running the same reason I ran for the State House for the first time a few years ago. This is my home. I love my home, just like you do. It's where I'm from and where I was raised, where I'm going to raise my son, Jack. And when you love your home, you want to take care of it. And I love this nation. That's why I'm running, because I know we can do better in Washington, D.C. We're all frustrated what's going on. And just as I was frustrated what was going on in Montgomery and tried to serve honorably and work hard and have made improvements, I know that I can do the same thing in Washington, D.C., by working hard to serve you, my neighbors, a place I call home.
Mr. Palmer?
Thank you for hosting this. And, we can, when we talk about so many people being disgusted with Congress, you've got a choice. You can either sit and be part of the crowd that does nothing but complain, or you can get up and do something about it. And I decided that I wanted to be part of that generation that gets our country back on the right track. I believe with all my heart that our best days are still ahead and that we can get America back on the right track. There's a window of opportunity here, but that window's going to close. And I just couldn't afford to sit around any longer and complain about what's going on in D.C. I wanted to be part of the solution.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let's move to a couple of the current events dominating our headlines today. Let's begin in Iraq. After years of American blood and treasure, the situation in Iraq, especially with ISIS, is growing more unstable by the day. What level of U.S. engagement would you support going forward to try and stabilize the situation, to try and salvage any gains we may have made there over the last decade? Mr. Palmer?
Well, first of all, we've had an unprecedented intelligence failure in Iraq. We should not have been caught flat-footed with what's happening right now. In terms of stabilizing the situation, I think we should consider establishing a no-fly zone like we did Iraq after the first Gulf War, and give the Iraqi government an opportunity to stabilize itself and give the Iraqi military a chance to reorganize and defend themselves. I do not think we should put any more boots on the ground. In addition, though, there are other things that we can do, and it begins with energy. The U.S. is an energy superpower. We need to open up our energy resources and become the world's largest supplier of oil and natural gas. That will dramatically change the dynamic in Iraq and in the Middle East, as well as in Europe with the Russians.
Mr. DeMarco.
Neither Gary nor I have the intelligence analysis that the President or Congress has to make the right decision on how you handle the crisis in Iraq now. But let me say this. before you make a decision on where you move forward with Iraq, you look at where we were. The men and women of the American military that served and served honorably in Iraq, families here in our community that lost soldiers, and those that lost life and lost limb. So to make a decision about how we move forward, you don't take the military off the table. But what you do is you look at the intelligence briefings, you make a decision. Some of what's going on now is political, but we have to make sure that we give that nation the support they need to move forward. You don't rule anything off the table based on the information. That's how you make the best decision. Look at the facts before us. Look at the intelligence briefings. And then you can make the best decision on how we move forward. That's the best way to move forward with policy. Not on the failures of the Obama administration, but based on what we need to do and what's right for that nation and what's the national security interest of this nation.
Let's stay in the topic of the military and a tangential scandal that's been going on for quite some time. I think we can all agree that the apparent mistreatment of veterans within the VA healthcare system is both shameful and scandalous. But the question for you, gentlemen, how would you propose to reform a system that is so large, so intricate, and so entrenched, and a service to a growing part of our population as more of our servicemen and women return home from the conflicts overseas? And Mr. DeMarco, I'll let you begin.
Yes, I think this is one of the greatest scandals of this administration. How we've treated the men and women, friends of ours, neighbors of ours, who serve this nation honorably. And if we can't treat our veterans in the way they deserve to be treated, how do we expect this administration to treat the rest of us when it comes to health care? But I'll tell you, how you have to do it is you have to have top to bottom look at this administration, this policy at the VA and the Veterans Administration, which means you have to go in and allow the accountability to take place, to fire those who treat our veterans the way they've been treated, fire those who cover up the way they've been treated, and to hold them accountable. And that's been the problem. There have been too many cover-ups going on at the Veterans Administration and not enough accountability to hold them from top to bottom, decisions being made locally and in Washington, D.C. And that means we've got to step up, and Congress has to step up to the plate and pass legislation, and work with the stakeholders. We hear a lot about what Congress is going to do, what the president needs to do, what the secretary of the VA needs to do, but you know who we need to hear from? The patients, the veterans themselves, on how best to reform the VA.
Mr. Palmer.
Yes. This will be part of overall health care reform. We need to make sure that our veterans have access to the doctors that they need to see, and something that we should have done a long time ago is to provide vouchers so that they don't have to go to the VA hospital. They can go to a regular physician and let the government pay for it with a voucher. That will dramatically expand access for our veterans to health care. We also need to do the fundamental reform of the entire VA system. We have a tradition in this country that we will leave no one behind. Well, that shouldn't just apply to the battlefield. It ought to apply after they get home from the battlefield. And we're going to have to look at overall reform of the VA system, make it part of the overall health care reform that we want to implement, and make sure that every veteran has access to the health care that they need. And I think the best way to do it is through a voucher program where they can go to a private physician.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let's spend the next couple of questions on a subject especially important to a lot of members of one of our sponsors, the AARP, and that is entitlement reform. Let's start with Social Security. How, and I would like to get as specific as we can here with some policy ideas, how you would protect Social Security both for today's seniors and also for generations coming behind who are concerned that those actuarial tables do not look particularly positive decades down the road. Mr. Palmer, we'll begin with you.
Well, they're predicting now that we will run out of money for Social Security by around 2035. And there was a report put out by the Pew Foundation that says that only 8% of millennials believe that they will get the Social Security benefits that they're entitled to, and 51% believe they won't get anything. I think the key is to make sure that Social Security is funded for everyone over age 50. And we can do that by using the royalties that this country can gain from opening up its energy resources. I've talked about this several times. There's a formation out west called the Green River Formation. It's in western Colorado, southwestern Wyoming, northern Utah, that, according to the Bureau of Land Management and the General Accountability Office, holds 3 trillion barrels of recoverable oil. That's 3 times what the world's used in the last 100 years. That's one formation. And the estimate on the royalties that I've seen is 14 trillion. We ought to open up these energy resources, take some of those royalties, make sure that Social Security is paid for everyone over 50, and then reform it on the back end with individual retirement accounts that will make sure that, the people who are putting aside for their retirement will have something when they reach that age. We should also look at increasing the retirement age, which will also help reduce the long-term unfunded liabilities.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Mr. DeMarco?
Yes. First and foremost, when you look at Social Security, you've got to make sure that you keep the promise to the seniors who expect these benefits and who have been relying on these benefits, and those who anticipate in the near future. So that's first and foremost. And then the next two guiding principles will be you don't raise taxes and you don't increase the debt. So how do you make sure Social Security is solvent for those who are younger? Well, you go to issues like Social Security disability. Let's talk about Social Security disability. Let's look here in the state of Alabama, where in Hale County, 1 in 4 working adults is on Social Security disability. 1 in 4. Ladies and gentlemen, that cannot continue. We cannot continue the same system where Social Security disability is so prevalent. There have been Senator Coburn has given examples of abuse of our Social Security system and Social Security disability. And you look at Medicare, where $19 billion of waste and fraud. You cannot continue and expect Social Security to be solvent without addressing issues of fraud, mismanagement. That's the first step you make to make it solvent.
Gentlemen, thank you. Let's move to the other part of entitlement reform, which perhaps is much more complicated to solve, and that is Medicare. How would you put that program on stronger financial ground, protecting, again, today's seniors and future retirees from rising health care costs? Mr. DeMarco, we'll begin with you.
I go back to what I just said. You look at the $19 billion in 2012. That type of abuse in the system is the way you've got to first address. You've got to address that first. Because how do you expect to solve the rest of the problems when you've got those millions of dollars being wasted? I mean, that's what the citizens expect to solve these problems. Take care of the fraud and the abuse in the Medicare system. You know, in Alabama, we've looked at trying to reform health care costs, and we're working on that to make changes here in Alabama. So you look at the states and what they're trying to do to control some of the cost by having regional organizations and having more local control on how those dollars are spent. But first and foremost, take care of the issues of fraud, and then come back and you look at how you can control costs on a more local level as opposed to it just being decisions made in Washington, D.C. The decisions made at the local ability, how to control costs, have worked across the country in the states, and they can work in Washington, D.C. as well.
Mr. Palmer, to you.
Well, the biggest crisis that we're facing right now is the sustainable growth rate, and Congress implemented this in 1997. They haven't enforced it since 2003. They're estimating now, and this has to do with the reimbursement rates for doctors, and that to try to reform this is going to cost about $116 billion. The only way that we can do this without increasing the deficit is to postpone the implementation of the mandates in Obamacare or repeal Obamacare. What we need to do is reform the entire system. We need to give seniors more choices. We need to make sure that they have access to the health care that they need. And we need to look at the opportunities that we have to provide them with savings accounts, whatever they need to buy private insurance as a supplement to Medicare. The long-term prospects for Medicare are not very good unless we have a total reform, not just reform a part of it like we've been doing for all these years, but look at comprehensive reform for Medicare.
Excellent. Gentlemen, let's stay on the topic of health care reform and move to the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as it's commonly known. Both of you cited a desire to repeal and replace it. First, and let's be specific, with what would you replace it? And a lot of people say the market-based approach. If you could get more specific than that in terms of what your version of health care reform would look like. Mr. Palmer, we'll start with you.
Well, you start with health savings accounts. There were, in that number of uninsured, there were millions of young people aged, 20 to 30, who simply made a decision not to buy health insurance because it didn't make sense to them to pay $300, $400 a month for a health insurance premium or $200 a month, whatever it was, for something they didn't think they'd use because they think they're indestructible. There's over 15 million people currently using health savings accounts. What this would do is it would allow them to control their spending and because they're basically spending their own money. They could purchase a health care plan with a $5,000 deductible and have $5,000 in their health savings account, and what they don't use, they keep. It rolls over year after year. So if they're only spending $500 a year, by the time they're 30 years old, they could have $25,000 in that account. That's a key component. It also, they're paying with a debit card, it becomes a cash transaction with the physician's office. So that's saving the physician's office probably 20% in administrative costs. That money will roll over each year. If they can get out of it and go into a regular health care plan, they can get an employer plan, they'll be able to buy it across state lines, they'll have portability. There'll be a national safety net to provide coverage for everyone else. But the key thing is with these health savings accounts, over time, by the time you retire, you will have money in an account that you can use to supplement your Medicare and buy additional insurance. And that's what we mean when we talk about bringing market principles back to health care.
Mr. Palmer, thank you. Mr. DeMarco, your plan.
Yes, there's legislation already out there, the American Health Reform Act, that had been discussed in the House that would provide for these market-based approaches of more choice and portability of insurance. And I think that's what Americans are looking for, all of us. I know I am, is if you work hard that you can afford to get the insurance to take care of your family. I think that's all where we were before this health care law was passed, that we had choices so that we could pay for the insurance and pay the premiums, but it allowed us to have the choices that were going to be limited with Obamacare. And I think that's the frustration. We want to keep, and we understand there are provisions, but pre-existing or those who are children up to age 26. But if you go back to where you were before, and then you add to that medical malpractice reform, competition across state lines, portability, I think if you put those together about where we were before, we can go back to where we were when it comes to health insurance. We didn't have a health care issue. We had a health insurance issue. But we threw the baby out with the bathwater. And that's why we are where we are right now with this law. We need to go back to a system where we put the patient first. And by allowing more choices, that puts the patients first, and that's what we need to do when it comes to health care.
Let me do a follow-up for you. Multiple attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act have failed so far because your party only controls one half of Congress, and the president wields a veto pen. Though control of the Senate is very much up for grabs, let's assume for the moment it were to remain in Democratic hands for the next 2 years. How would you work within the existing ACA format and framework to try and make reforms, perhaps, that you think are a start in the right direction, or do you believe it is just an intractable reality? Mr. DeMarco, we'll start with you.
No, you've got to get back, and I'll say, I think it is the mission of this nation to send the next men and women to Congress whose mission, whose goal, is to repeal and replace Obamacare. Too many men and women across this nation, in this state, in this community, are concerned about what the future will hold. When you talk to small businessmen and businesswomen and what they've had to do when it comes to the potential of laying off people because of the health care law, and that they won't be able to hire more employees, and that they will have part-time workers, you cannot continue to allow this law to move forward as it is, because if you do, it will continue to be a job killer. So you continue to look at repealing and replacing this law. And I do think there will be a Republican majority in the Senate, and we'll finally be able to make the changes. And whether you do it piecemeal or try to defund portions of it, we can change this law. We've had reform in the past of other legislation, and we can do it. So I don't take it that you can just give up and say, we're going to live with this. We've made reforms, and we will make reforms to this law because that's what the American people know is in the best interest of health care, is to make the changes to this law and keep those one or two provisions about pre-existing, but to go back and go to the Health Reform Act and make the other changes that we deserve in this country.
Thank you, Mr. DeMarco. Mr. Palmer.
Well, I'm going to answer the question in two parts. The first part is what would we do if the Democrats continued to control the Senate? And right now there's between 80 and 90, maybe more than 90 lawsuits filed against Obamacare in federal court. I think what will happen is if the Republicans do not take the Senate, that you will continue to see this litigated and see certain aspects of this enjoined until it goes to the Supreme Court. But the second way I want to answer this is that I firmly believe that the Republicans are going to win the Senate, and as I've said several times, Jeff Sessions will chair the Budget Committee in the Senate, and we will pass budgets. Right, the Senate, the Congress hasn't passed a budget in 5 or 6 years. They're operating on continuing resolutions. What people need to understand is even if the Republicans win the Senate, it's going to take at least 2, maybe 3 years to repeal and replace Obamacare. It may take a little bit longer. But what we can do in the interim when we pass budgets and go to reconciliation on the budgets is zero out a lot of these programs, zero fund these programs, and cut them off. And work. Congress should work with states in litigation to enjoin other aspects of it. Once we get to 2016 and a Republican president is elected, I think we will repeal Obamacare and we'll replace it with a market-based system.
Gentlemen, thank you. Let's move to a topic dear to the folks who walk this campus every day, and that's the cost of tuition at public universities. We have some students from Jeff State who have joined us here in the crowd today. The cost has risen more than 30% at the average student in the last 10 years, still rising at a rate of more than 3% a year. What would you do to either try and slow that rise or perhaps blunt the increasing cost and, more importantly, the resulting student debt that threatens to swamp this generation of students? Mr. Palmer, we'll start with you.
Well, I think we could apply some market principles to education as well, and I think internet-based learning is going to be a huge factor in this. I think that in many respects, college education is overpriced. I think a lot of students need to make decisions about where they go to school based on what they want to do as a career and what they can afford. I grew up dirt poor. I mean, I had cardboard between the tube floors in the bedroom that I shared with my brother. I'm the first person in my family to go to college. I worked part-time. I've got grants, and I borrowed money. But I didn't borrow more than I could pay back, and I paid back every dime of it. I think that ought to be part of the equation, and I think the parents have got to be diligent in helping their children make decisions about where they go to school and what they're willing to spend based on what they're going to do when they get out of school. I think again, these market as education changes, and particularly with internet-based education, you're going to see more and more people getting their higher education online and seeking other means, and I think that's going to bring down cost when these schools have to compete.
Mr. DeMarco, to you.
I think how you keep tuition, look around this room. Look at this building. You know, this building wasn't here a long time ago. It was built because there was a need. And the leadership from Dr. Merritt, the state of Alabama, to build this campus. And so what you have is when students were looking for places to go to school, they have a cost-effective way to get a great education. And so you look around this country as the rising tuition, you look at places like Jeff State who do provide an affordable education. And I think that's what we need to do. But when it comes to education, the federal government needs to get out of the education business. And the federal government doesn't need to be telling states what it needs to do when it comes to education. Those are local decisions. The parents in Alabama, the teachers, the principals, those who need to be making the decisions when it comes to education. Congress does not need to be making decisions about education.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let's move to some Republican Party issues. Begin with the Tea Party. Its influence has been a divisive issue within the general party in the last couple of years. A two-part question. First, would you call yourself a member of the Tea Party? And as a follow-up, how do you plan to appeal to Republican voters in this district who either associate themselves with the party, Tea Party that is, or not with it? Mr. DeMarco, start with you.
Well, those of us who are for limited government, not raising taxes, less regulation, to protect our constitutional liberties? Isn't that what the Tea Party's about? So that would make us all Tea Party. That's what it's about. And that's especially here in the 6th Congressional District, here in Alabama, something we're proud of, where we dare defend our rights. So I take what's happened in this country the past couple of weeks, is frustration in what's going on in Washington, D.C. And that frustration has been expressed, vocal expression of the frustration of what we can do to change this country and go back to the freedoms and constitutional liberties. So, yes, I would consider myself, I think like everybody in this room, part of the Tea Party. What to bring us together? Just common sense. Going to Washington, D.C. and representing the people. Something I have worked hard to do as a state representative, put the people first. Local control. That's what you do to bring people together. Just common sense approaches. Something we're lacking in Washington, D.C. right now. And that's why I will always, if I'm honored and elected, live here and commute up to Washington, D.C., because I will take Alabama values to Washington, D.C., not bring Washington, D.C. values back to Alabama.
Mr. Palmer, to you.
The Tea Party, I think, is representative of the frustration that people have and with the direction that the country's going. It started over taxes and Obamacare, but it's really about restoring the American Republic. It is a continuation of the American Revolution, and I think, frankly, that our founding fathers would be very proud of this movement. I get a little frustrated with people who try to single them out as being extremists, and that's what's going on within the party. I think that's wrong. I think the founding fathers, as I said, would be quite proud of this movement. I think everybody in this room is concerned about the future of the nation. They want to see us get back on the right track. And in my opening comments, when I was asked why I ran for Congress, I ran because, like the members of the Tea Party, I could no longer sit back and watch our country go down a path that is irreversible decline. These are people who are determined to not sit around and do nothing, but to get back, get engaged, and get our country back on the right path. And I'm proud of them.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let's stay in that same vein. This is obviously one of the most conservative, reliably Republican congressional districts in the country, creating overwhelming odds that the winner of this runoff would more than likely win the general election in November. What would you say to voters who live in the 6th Congressional District who are either considered independents, maybe registered Democrats? How would you plan to represent their interests as you're charged to do if you were to win the general election? Mr. Palmer, we'll start with you.
Well, I have said that this is the third most Republican district in the country, and the only way that a Republican could lose this to a Democrat is they came out against college football. And having played football at Alabama, I can assure you I will not do that. And I probably lost half the crowd with that comment. But everybody benefits from good leadership. And I'm looking at this district and the opportunities that we have here. We haven't had a major economic project in this district in over a decade, actually. And I think if I can get to Washington and get back here and get this the congressional office and make it a center that represents everybody and represents the economic opportunity that we have here, we can have a tremendous economy in this area that will benefit everybody. As I pointed out the other night at the last debate, our railways reach 78% of this country. That means that this ought to be an epicenter for manufacturing. We've got the third largest oil sands discovery in the United States in North Alabama, 7.5 billion barrels of oil. We have tremendous opportunities here. And I think what I'd be able to do is to bring people together, get them working together. I've told the mayors throughout the district that I'd like to host a quarterly lunch. I won't run it. I'll facilitate it. And I want to get them together because I think they'll find out two things. They'll find out, first of all, that they can work together, and secondly, that they like each other.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Mr. DeMarco?
Well, I've found when you're working with constituent issues, you don't ask whether somebody's Republican or Democrat. When you're in Chelsea and you get stopped at the train track and you got to figure out how to make that infrastructure change, I wouldn't ask whether somebody's Republican or Democrat. When you're in Helena, looking at the infrastructure needs over there to have more roads to get in and out of Helena, You don't ask Republican or Democrat. You look around Shelby County, the growth in Shelby County, it's not a Republican or Democrat issue. What you're looking for is a congressman who knows the county, who knows the people, who will work with the elected officials, the county commission, the mayors. That's what you're looking for in a congressman, somebody who's accessible and available, who will be around to work with the people of Shelby County to help with their needs. And maybe somebody who's a veteran who has an issue at the VA. It's not a Republican or Democrat issue. And first and foremost, as a congressman, it's your number one responsibility is taking care of your constituents when they have an issue dealing with the federal bureaucracy to make sure that as your congressman, you're there to help them get through the maze, to be their advocate. An advocate I will do for the folks of Shelby County.
Gentlemen, let's talk. You mentioned infrastructure, both of you, in your answers, so we'll move to that subject quickly. And I'm going to try and fold in about three questions into this, so bear with me. And I hate when people do that, but for the sake of time, I'm going to try anyway. Traffic in the metro area is not just a nuisance. It's a roadblock to economic development and to job growth. What would you do to try and provide new infrastructure or improve existing transportation infrastructure? I'm thinking specifically of a road that has three numbers in it that's about six lanes too short. Many of us fought on the way down here tonight. Also, the Northern Beltline project, if you could mention your support or not of that project. And then keeping in mind with your answer that you'll be replacing one of the more powerful Republican chairman, former chairman of the Finance Committee, and you'll be a freshman with very little pull. So keeping in mind that pragmatic reality, what can you do in your first term to try and help the infrastructure that Birmingham so desperately needs? Mr. DeMarco?
I'm assuming you were talking about Highway 280?
That might be. I'm paid to be impartial, but
you know, like I said, I've lived here my whole life. I remember where the original Lloyd's was, if that tells you something. So when 280 was going back to the original Lloyd's restaurant here, I'll tell you, you partner with the states. You look at some of the changes that Governor Bentley has made and worked on. The past couple of years, we studied 280. About 30% of the problem is at the intersection of 459 and 280. You look at how the roads go into 280. So we've got to work with the state of Alabama and the Alabama Department of Transportation when it comes to that intersection right there, 459 and 280. That'll solve some of the problems when it comes to 280. When it comes to the Northern Beltline, I do support the Northern Beltline because if you spend any time in Trafford or Kimberly or Morris or Mount Olive, or any of the locations, you know, they want what the rest of us want. You know, access to health care, infrastructure that will grow the economy. And so as you look around this state, we have infrastructure needs. And the best way to do it, again, is to get the stakeholders, the mayors and the county commissioners who work with the local citizens to make those infrastructure needs. Something I've got the experience of doing, something I've worked with the citizens, and something I'll continue to do if you honor me by electing me as your congressman.
Mr. Palmer, same question to you, sir.
I've worked on the 280 issue when they were talking about building an elevated highway, and I'm glad they didn't because that basically becomes a car cannon, and you lose your retail, and you'll lose a lot of the character of the region. There's a lot that we can do. What is known as Cahaba River Road is really an old U.S. highway that was deeded over to the state, and we have that and the right-of-ways there. So we've got some opportunities to do what Charlotte and Pittsburgh and some other cities have done, and this is a little engineering technical, I guess, but build what's known as elongated diamonds. What you're doing is you're creating service roads so that you may exit a quarter mile from where you're actually going, but it gets you off the main stream of traffic and reduces the number of traffic lights that you need. And we've also got some opportunities to open up new access routes, such as Grants Mill Road and some place like that. So the road builders are going to have a lot to do over the next few years. In terms of the Northern Beltway, I'm a big supporter of that, have been for years. But I think what we need to do when we build that is not build what we need right now, build what we need 20 years from now, because we don't want to become Atlanta. And I've talked with the mayor of Warrior and some of these other mayors, and they're already talking to some of the big box retailers. It's going to give them access to retail shopping that they've never had before. And it's also going to open up housing development where people are going to be able to buy high-quality homes at an affordable price when this is opened up. So it's going to be huge for the economy of the 6th District.
Gentlemen, thank you. Let's move to a subject that has been the subject of some rather intense debate between your campaigns in the last 48 hours or so, and that is taxes. The budget, of course, is not balanced. It isn't even close to being balanced at the federal budget. That's something both of you said you'd like to try and do. Let's start with a principle. Is there any scenario in which you would support, I hesitate to say the word tax increase, perhaps revenue enhancement is another way of putting it, for the federal government going forward? Is it possible in your mind to simply cut our way to a balanced and healthy budget? Mr. Palmer, we'll begin with you.
Well, I think we have to do two things. One is that I want to look at every federal discretionary program, and there's somewhere in the range of 2,000 of those. I've talked to Senator Sessions about it. I talked to Senator Coburn briefly about it in a meeting in Oklahoma. And what we need to do is look at every program and create a catalog. And we need to define the program, say what it does, how many people it employs, and what it spends, and then start asking some questions. The first question is this program relevant? If it's not, if it's obsolete, you quit doing it. The next question is this something that government is supposed to do? And if it's not, then you don't do it. If it is something that needs to be done, then the next question is, can the private sector do it? If the private sector can do it, then contract it out. The next question is it duplicated at any level of the federal government? The GAO, General Accountability Office, put out a report about 2 months ago that identified 188 programs that are either duplications or have an inherent inefficiency. So a lot of that work's already been done. But the last question is my favorite one. Is this duplicated at the state level? If it is, move it to the states. That would include the Department of Education. The best education dollars are spent closest to the students and to the families. And with the EPA even, every state has a Department of Environmental Management. I don't know of a politician in any party that's for dirty water, dirty air, poisoned soil, or cutting all the trees. Bring that down here. Keep a smaller EPA that will be the mediator between the states, but bring that here, and that will stimulate the economy, and that will produce the revenues that we need.
Mr. Palmer, thank you. Mr. DeMarco?
Well, I guess this is one area I would disagree with Gary. I'm not going to Washington, D.C. to look to them to answers. I'm going to start here for looking answers, because here at home, we do know how to balance our budget. Here in the state of Alabama, it's constitutionally required we do balance our budget. So I'm not looking for answers in Washington, D.C. They failed when it comes to balancing our budget. You look across this nation at the state's level, the states balance their budget. We balance our budget here in Alabama. And how do we do that? We prioritize what's important to the citizens of the state of Alabama when it comes to education and the Education Trust Fund, and when it comes to the general fund and taking care of the rest of the needs in the state of Alabama, like public safety and mental health. We put those on the table. We debate them, and then we balance the budget. We look at the different agencies. We have a sunset provision rules about whether we need those agencies, and the legislature takes a look at those on a yearly and every other couple of year basis. So look what's going on at the states. The states are balancing their budgets. The states are prioritizing. The states are looking and consolidating agencies. Here in Alabama, we had over 20 different public safety agencies. Now we have 7. We consolidated them, still providing the level of service that you, the citizens, expect, but we made state government more efficient without raising taxes. And that's what you expect in the state of Alabama. That's what you should expect in Washington, D.C.
Let me follow up here and talk about the tax code. And I want to reiterate a part of the last question I don't think we got a clear answer on from either of you, so I'll sort of include it in this as well. Tax reform, it's something both parties have agreed the tax code's too complicated, needs to be overhauled. No substantive progress has been made in a long time in doing that since the late 80s, basically. What would you do to spark movement on this issue? And again, as part of any tax reform, is there any scenario in which you would support some kind of either revenue enhancement or tax increase of some sort to make the tax reform or balanced budget happen? Mr. DeMarco, we'll start with you.
Okay. I'll make it crystal clear if I didn't before. I would never support a tax or revenue enhancement in Washington, D.C. in Congress. So let's start off with that. You know, as for tax reform, it was recommended, and I started reading the book by former Congressman John Linder and Neil Bortz about the fair tax. And I'll tell you what attracts me about the fair tax is getting rid of the IRS once and for all. You look what the IRS has done in targeting conservatives and the cover-up that's going on right now, and the public has lost faith in the IRS. So how do you expect to have an agency to come and collect revenue to run this country when the people themselves don't have faith in the agency that's supposed to be collecting those taxes. So Congress has got to collectively sit down and finally make a decision on how we're going to reform the tax code. But based on what's going on in the IRS and the cover-up and the lies and the misrepresentations, just today, the past couple of days, coming from the IRS commissioner, we cannot continue with an agency that the American people has lost faith.
Thank you, Mr. DeMarco. Mr. Palmer, to you, sir.
Well, first of all, I've signed the No New Tax Pledge by the Americans for Tax Reform, so I am absolutely opposed to any tax increase. I also support the fair tax, but there's a key provision that has to take place first, and that is repeal of the 16th Amendment. We cannot expose the American people to a consumption tax, a national sales tax, if there's any chance at all that Congress could bring back an income tax. So we will have to first repeal the 16th Amendment. Then I would support a fair tax. I also support the flat tax. I have worked for years. I was one of the guys who helped found the American Family Business Institute in Washington working on repeal of the death tax, the estate tax. That needs to go. People shouldn't be taxed twice on what they've earned and built and want to pass on to their children. We also need to look at the corporate income tax. We've got the highest corporate income tax in the world. We literally have companies that are now looking to locate their headquarters in other countries to avoid our corporate income tax. There's a pharmaceutical company in Chicago, Horizon Pharma, just paid, I think, 30% more than the market value for a pharmaceutical company in Ireland. Because if they have 20% of their holdings are overseas, they can relocate their headquarters and be taxed under that nation. Our corporate income tax is 35%. Ireland's is 12.5%. So we need to cut or eliminate the corporate income tax, which will repatriate about $1.5 trillion to this country.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Let's move to the state's prison system. It has been the focus of a lot of negative attention, including federal investigations as we speak for the conditions at Tutwiler Prison. What steps would you take in Congress to try and provide help to the state's prison system? What recommendations would you make for its improvement? Mr. Palmer, we'll start with you.
Well, I don't know that Congress has a role in telling the states what to do with their prisons. We've been down that road before with federal judges telling us how to run our prisons. What we need to do are focus on state solutions. And one of the things that I think are for the current prison population, over 60% of them are high school dropouts. I've talked to Dr. Tommy Bice about this. We have the top distance learning program in the country. We need to go into our prisons with this distance learning program and give these nonviolent offenders who are going to be paroled the opportunity to earn a high school diploma or an associate or vocational degree. Get them with prison reentry ministries so that when they leave prison, they're ready to enter the workforce, they're ready to reenter society. On the other end of the equation, we've got schools all over the state that have dropout rates higher than 60%. Johns Hopkins University put out a report, and they call these schools dropout factories. Well, I want to tell you, these aren't dropout factories, they're inmate factories. We need to improve education, reduce the dropout rate in this state. And if we reduce the dropout rate by 5%, according to one of the studies that I read, it'll save the state $125 million a year, and a lot of that's in the criminal justice system.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Mr. DeMarco, to you.
The last thing we need is federal involvement in our criminal justice system in the state of Alabama. And I would oppose any attempt by Congress to get involved in the criminal justice system in the state of Alabama. You know, we've got frontline law enforcement, frontline prosecutors who work every day to put the public first. And so when it comes to reforming the issues, when it comes to our prisons, there have already been efforts have already started last year, in the past couple of years, when it comes to sitting down with the stakeholders, those in the judicial system, the prosecutors, law enforcement, our judges, victims' rights groups, say, what do we do? And we've looked at drug courts and community corrections. And those are some of the efforts that are going on right now and will continue. And with those efforts and looking at the funding that has been going on when it comes to our prison systems, we can make the reforms that we need here in the state of Alabama. But we can do it without any involvement of the federal government. There have been some sentencing guideline changes that have been made. There have been some recommendations, and there's a study group right now looking at the prison system in the state of Alabama. And I'm confident we'll make the changes we need here in Alabama, but we will do it without any federal involvement.
Let's move to the topic of surveillance. It's been an issue that has gotten a lot of attention as well lately. What level of surveillance do you support for the NSA to use in monitoring U.S. citizens on our home soil? Do you believe they have already overreached? And how would you balance the need for intelligence with the citizens' right to privacy? Mr. DeMarco?
Well, that's the first question on the table. We want to make sure that we balance our civil liberties, our constitutional protections, with national security. And I do not believe that the NSA should be eavesdropping on American citizens. Let's make that clear. But there is legislation already in place that Congress passed decades ago that said if there is a national security issue, that you have to get a warrant to be able to listen in on those conversations. So let's follow the law that we have in place when it comes to NSA. And at the same time, all of us in this room, none of us wants to have another 9/11. None of us. There's a lot of talk about what you do when it comes to these laws and getting rid of some of these laws. So let's make sure we balance. Make sure we don't have invasion of our privacy or eavesdropping. But at the same time, let's make sure we never, ever forget, as we get further away from 9/11, what happened on that terrible day, that it never happens again.
Mr. Palmer, to you.
I think the Fourth Amendment's clear that the Constitution says that we will be secure in our persons, houses, papers, and effects, and I don't think there's anything that is in dispute there, and I think it needs to be clear to our national security agencies that they're not to infringe upon our constitutional rights. We can exercise the due diligence that we need to in terms of protecting our country without going to the extremes of listening in on every private citizen's conversations. Other nations do this. Israel does it. We don't have to do this. I pointed out that back in the late 90s, the Pentagon carried out an intelligence operation called Operation Able Danger. They had already identified Mohammed Atta, the guy who led and carried out the 9/11 attack, over 2 years before that occurred. But because there was a wall of separation created by the Clinton administration, by Jamie Gorelick, the Deputy Attorney General under Janet Reno, they were unable to share that intelligence information with the FBI or with the CIA. And as a result, the 9/11 attack occurred. We have the tools that we need to carry out the intelligence that we need to protect this country without infringing upon the constitutional rights of the American public.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. This will be our final question before closing statements, and I want to put the focus on immigration reform. It's an issue that has divided the country, divided your party, perhaps cost Eric Cantor his job a couple of weeks ago. Many people have said the Republican Party must find some way to widen its tent, if you will. How would you propose to do immigration reform in a way that is inclusive and also secures the borders and maintains the security and sovereignty of the country and its borders? Mr. Palmer, we'll start with you.
Well, I think that we're getting the cart before the horse on that end. I think what we've got to do is uphold the law. We've got to secure our borders. It's not just a matter of keeping people from coming in as immigrants. It's a matter of national security as well. So we've got to secure our borders. The other thing is that we've got to uphold our law. We are a nation of laws and not men. That's commonly referred to as the rule of law. If we have laws that we don't respect, and particularly if our president and our Congress doesn't respect those laws, the entire country is going to lose confidence and respect for the law. What's going on right now on our border is a constitutional crisis. And I think that before we have any discussion about where we go after in the future on the immigrants who are here, we have got to deal with that.
Mr. Palmer, thank you. Mr. DeMarco, to you.
Back in elementary school, when you start learning about this country, you study in the Constitution, think about that. What do you learn? Learn that you got to follow the law. As a child, you understand you have to follow the rules. I said, I've got a young son, Jack. I'm going to be teaching him. He's got to follow the rules. We live in the greatest country in the world. And right now, we have people that don't respect our borders. And until you get people to understand that they've got to respect that we are a nation of laws and we're going to secure our borders. You can't get to the next question. As a congressman, I would push to once and for all secure our borders. And then I would oppose amnesty, because if you don't secure the border and you provide amnesty, you will tell those people waiting in line, those who want to follow the law, that we don't respect the rules that we've had in place, how you become a citizen, the privilege and honor of becoming a citizen in this country. That's my guiding principle when it comes to immigration. Secure the border and never allow amnesty for someone who breaks the law.
Gentlemen, thank you. It's time for closing statements. 2 minutes for each candidate. We flip the coin backstage, and Mr. Palmer will go first.
Well, again, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. We're 3 weeks out from the election, and what I want to tell you is that we have an opportunity to get this country going in the right direction. We've got the energy resources to drive economic growth in this country that will allow us to dominate the world economy for two decades. We know what we need to do to repeal and replace Obamacare. We know how to get our country back. The thing, you mentioned Eric Cantor and his loss and tied that to immigration. That may have been part of it. Some people say it was the establishment versus the Tea Party. That may have been part of it. But Cantor is in a district that has where over 700,000 people live. There's probably 450 to 480, 500,000 eligible voters. Only 70,000 people voted in that. And I think people didn't turn out to vote because they're giving up on the country. I think what we need to do is give people a vision for how we can be part of history making to get our country back. And I want you to understand that this is not the worst it's ever been in this country. Many of you in this room remember 1979. We had double-digit inflation, double-digit unemployment. Consumer interest rates were double digits. The Soviets were in Central America. They were in the Caribbean and in Africa. They invaded Afghanistan later that year. 52 Americans were being held hostage in their embassy in Tehran. But that's not all that was happening that year. There was a guy named Reagan running for president, talking specifically about how to deal with the Soviets and how to get our economy growing again. Margaret Thatcher got elected prime minister in Great Britain, and Pope John Paul II went back to his native country of Poland, and in a mass that he held outside the city of Krakow, told those people that love is stronger than death, faith is stronger than death, do not despair, do not give up, do not be defeated. Almost 8 years to the day later, Ronald Reagan stood outside the Brandenburg Gate and said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And 17 months later, it's down. If any of us had said in 1979, in 10 years, we'll be in the middle of the greatest economic expansion the world's ever seen, and the Iron Curtain will come down, people would have thought we were nuts. But the whole world was changing. And I believe it's changing again. I want you to be part of it. Thank you.
Mr. Palmer, thank you. Mr. DeMarco, your closing statement.
This past Saturday, I was sitting in Helena, overlooking Buck Creek, eating a cheeseburger, looking at the families playing in the creek, looking at those sitting inside the restaurant, thinking, this is what makes this country great. People don't want to worry about what's going on in Washington, D.C., and the frustrations. They want to take care of their families. They want to provide for their children, make sure they have great education. They want to live their lives. They want to live their lives without a lot of intervention from Washington, D.C. They want to make sure that we live in a secure and safe country. And the way to do that is you elect men and women of courage who are willing to go to Washington, D.C. and tackle the tough issues. Because I was sitting out looking at those families. They don't ask for much. They ask for folks who are honest, who aren't going to be show horses, who are going to be work horses, who are going to go and work for them and be their advocate. And when you have a problem going on at the VA, to handle it, to ask the tough questions. When you have the problems at the IRS, to handle it, to ask the tough questions. And to come back home and represent them honorably and professionally. And to do that, we want somebody who's got the experience, who can show up on day one, go to Washington, D.C., advocate for you, and then come back home, come back here to Shelby County and the rest of the 6th Congressional District. That's what you're looking for in elected officials, folks who are accessible, available, approachable, something I've worked very hard to do as your state representative, and I will look forward to doing as your congressman.
Mr. DeMarco, thank you. I want to take this opportunity to thank all of our sponsors, the AARP, the Greater Shelby County Chamber of Commerce, Jefferson State Community College, Fox 6, and WBHM, and allow you now to express your appreciation to both gentlemen for sharing their time with us tonight.
You've been listening to a candidates forum for the Republican primary runoff for Alabama's 6th Congressional District, right here on your NPR News Station, 90.3 WBHM or 91.5 WSGM. It was between State Representative Paul DeMarco and policy analyst Gary Palmer. It was recorded June 24th at the Jefferson State Community College Shelby Hoover campus and moderated by Fox 6 anchor Jonathan Hardison. I'm Andrew Yeager, and don't forget, the runoff election is July 15th. Thanks for listening.